This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Just a couple hundred people hear their names called in the NFL draft every year. Far fewer become astronauts. Exactly one person has done both. But growing up in a working-class African-American family in 1960s Virginia, Leland Melvin never imagined he would make history. Reporter Tal Pinchevsky shares his journey.
Four forward, drifting to the right a little. Ready? Down a half. 30 seconds.
Leland Melvin was 5 years old when the Apollo 11 spaceflight landed Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon and into history.
We copy you down, Eagle.
He remembers adjusting the antenna on a Sylvania black and white television so that his family could witness the historic moment.
So the next day, all my friends were saying, hey, you know, do you want to be an astronaut? We have Neil and Buzz walked on the moon, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. And I said, no, I don't want to be an astronaut, because I saw these guys in crew cuts and they were military, and I didn't think that I would want to do something like that. I didn't see someone who looked like me either. I grew up in a small southern town in Lynchburg, Virginia, and most of the people that I knew were, you know, African Americans, were school teachers, because that was kind of the highest position that you could get. I didn't know of any bankers or lawyers or people like that. It's one of those things where, you know, you kind of know your place. You know, you would watch the television, you would see buses are getting firebombed, and you'd see these, you know, these things happening to people that look like you. So you know that, you know, you can't just do everything that anyone else can do. You have to make sure that you're treading, I'm not going to say lightly, but treading in a way that's not going to disrupt the apple cart and will take not only you out, but maybe take even your family out or your community out.
Growing up, Leland loved playing with Tinker Toys and blocks. He liked building things. And when he was 8 years old, he got his hands on a new source of fun.
Yeah, my mother had the, I guess, wherewithal or misfortune in buying me an age-inappropriate, non-OSHA certified chemistry set. She said, follow the instructions, and I threw the instructions over my shoulder, and I proceeded to mix these two dissimilar chemicals together that created the most incredible explosion in her living room. And I just remember it getting on the rug and the rug burning. And I was like, wow, look at this. Smoke, fire, and brimstone right here from these two little beakers. And I was like blown away. I was actually blown back and there was smoke. But if you looked at my eyes, my brain was activated. You could see my eyes as wide open as possible. And my parents didn't make much money. So this is like, you don't do that. You don't mess up the sofa and you don't mess up the rug. But it didn't matter to me, because I knew all I needed was a lab coat and goggles and I could be a chemistry major or a scientist.
Leland's interest in science and engineering skyrocketed. In high school, he attended a special engineering program at the University of Virginia that specifically targeted minority students. He collected old bicycle parts and used them to build his own personalized bike. He helped his father refurbish an old bread truck into a family camper, complete with a stove and flip-down bunk beds. He had always been an athlete. He started playing football at age 7 and grew up idolizing another Virginian, tennis legend Arthur Ashe. But he thought science would shape his future, until one big play during the homecoming game in his senior year of high school.
I was running down the sideline, Stan Hull threw this perfect spiral into the corner of the end zone, and the ball is coming. I can see this whole thing playing out. The ball is coming into my hands. I looked into the stands a little bit, heard the crowd screaming, knew that I was going to be winning this game by catching this ball, and I dropped it in the end zone. And I felt about the size of a gnat. And I walked to the sideline. My coach, Jimmy Green, grabbed my face mask, looked me in the eyes, and he says, Leland, I believe in you. Get back out there and catch the ball this time. Run the same play. Catch the ball. And I was so embarrassed because my friends and family were there, and I just wanted to sit down and go away. But running down the sideline second time, I could read Spalding on the ball as it came into my hands, and we won the game. Unbeknownst to me, there was a scout by the name of Morgan Hout from the University of Richmond who was watching the first mishap in the end zone. He started walking out of the stadium. He heard the crowd screaming the second time. And he came back and saw me doing a little dance in the end zone. And he said to himself, he said, this guy, he failed horrifically, but he didn't give up. And that one catch resulted in a $180,000 scholarship to the University of Richmond.
In Leland's first season for the Spiders, Richmond went winless. But Leland developed into a standout wide receiver, establishing school records for career receptions and receiving yards. He became a two-time honorable mention All-American. The Detroit Lions selected him in the 11th round of the 1986 NFL draft, but then cut him after he was slowed by a hamstring injury during training camp. Leland started pursuing a graduate degree in material science engineering at the University of Virginia, but before the 1987 NFL season, he got an invitation to Dallas Cowboys training camp. Leland didn't put his studies on hold.
So before online learning became a thing, they were videotaping VHS videotapes of math for material science and electrochemistry that they sent to Valley Ranch for me to watch after catching footballs during the day for America's team. That was the hardest job I've ever had, to train to be a professional football player and go to grad school at the same time. And grad school as in material science engineering. And in the evenings, a lot of my colleagues were like, hey, let's go out to a club or let's go do this. I'm like, no, I got to watch material science engineering videotapes. So I was Larry Lab, or the nerd. They call me the nerd guy.
During a routine passing drill with Dallas quarterback Danny White, things suddenly changed for Larry Lab.
We were planning to throw a half-speed 10-yard out, and he did an audible when he saw Tom Landry walking on the field.
Tom Landry was a future Hall of Fame coach, and White saw an opportunity to impress the football icon. He told Leland to run as far and as fast as he could.
So I went for it, pulled my hamstring, but I thank Danny White for helping me get the space. Because if it hadn't been for that, possibly, who knows where I would have been.
Leland's NFL career was over. He went back to grad school full-time, finished his master's degree in material science engineering, and, as Leland jokes, did what many former NFL players do. He went to work for NASA. He started in 1989 as an engineer at Langley Research Center, making optical fiber sensors. By 1998, he began astronaut training at Johnson Space Center. He appeared to be on the fast track to space, but then...
April 2001, I was training to do something called a spacewalk, which is really more like a space crawl because you're pulling yourself around with your hands and you're not walking, you're floating, doing things like assembling the International Space Station. And my training of this, to train to simulate this on the ground, is in a 5-million-gallon pool that's called the Neutral Buoyancy Laboratory. And I was in this suit that's a cross between the Michelin Man and a Pillsbury Doughboy, going down 32 feet in the water, and we're actually, you know, going to be training on submerged space stations and space shuttles to simulate what we would do on our missions.
As he descended into the pool, Leland had trouble hearing his instructor. Soon he was hearing nothing but static. When he was pulled from the pool and his helmet was removed, it quickly became clear that something was wrong.
The flight surgeon started walking towards me, and he was just moving his lips, and I thought he was just playing with me. And I said, this is serious. Why is he playing with me? But when he touched my ear and pulled his finger back, I felt this river of blood rolling down the side of my face. I was completely deaf. After emergency surgery in the hospital, the world-renowned ear, nose, and throat doctors said that, you know, they don't know what happened to me and that I would never fly in space.
Unbeknownst to Leland, his suit had been missing its Valsalva pad, a small styrofoam insert that helps astronauts equalize the extreme pressure that can build up in their ears. About 3 weeks after the accident, Leland's hearing returned to his right ear, but damage to his left ear remained. His dream of orbiting planet Earth appeared to be over. Leland shifted his focus at NASA. He worked on robotics and joined an educator's program in which he traveled across the country, encouraging children to nominate their teachers to become astronauts.
And I'm working in this job, and we're going around the country getting kids to nominate their teachers to become astronauts. And one of the kids says, hey, have you flown in space yet? I said, no. And he says, well, you're not an astronaut. Astronauts fly in space. And I'm like, kid, shut up. I'm just like getting, you know, not angry, but I'm thinking, will I ever fly in space?
Leland was still working with kids and teachers on February 1st, 2003, the day the space shuttle Columbia was scheduled to return from its 28th mission in space.
When you're landing, there's a countdown clock to where the wheels should touch down on the runway in Florida. Well, I get a phone call from my education boss, and she's new to NASA, and she says to me, she says, Leland, what does it mean when the countdown clock is now counting up? And I said, how much is it counting up? And she said, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, 40 seconds, a minute. I did an illegal U-turn on Highway 66 outside of D.C. and turned back to NASA because I knew that all of my friends were gone.
A catastrophe in the sky.
Columbia's last communication was received at about 8 a.m. Central Time as Columbia flew 200,000 feet above North Central Texas.
We are seeing huge pieces of metal re-entering the Earth's atmosphere.
All seven Columbia crew members died, including David M. Brown, one of Leland Melvin's close friends.
And that night I went to David Brown's parents' home in Washington, Virginia, to console them. And when I got there, David's father said something so powerful to me. He said, we must honor the legacy of my son and the crew who gave their lives for our civilization, for humanity, for doing these incredible, incredible feats. And I thought that, you know, I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to honor them if I'm medically disqualified to fly. And we went to the different memorial services around the country, and the chief of all the flight surgeons, as we were taking off and landing in the NASA airplane, the chief of all the flight surgeons was sitting beside me on every takeoff and landing, and he watched me clear my ears on descent.
At the time, Leland was getting ready to move from Washington to Houston to continue his life as a non-flying astronaut. But as the chief flight surgeon watched Leland clear his ears to combat the cabin pressure on these flights, he saw an opportunity to resuscitate the Earthbound astronauts' dreams of spaceflight.
Rich Williams said, come in my office, and he gave me this waiver to fly in space, even though my hearing had not changed significantly. He felt like if I could effectively clear my ears, then there'd be no reason why I shouldn't be able to fly in space. He believed in me. You know, I got this get-out-of-jail-free card. I head back to Houston, and soon after that, I get assigned to a mission.
Leland Melvin went on to participate in two missions to the International Space Station. His Detroit Lions jersey, which he brought with him into space, is now exhibited at the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. He's been an NFL player and an astronaut. But more than anything, Leland has become an advocate for what is possible.
I'll never forget when I first became an astronaut, when I was on a fire truck driving down the boulevards in Houston, celebrating John Glenn's return to flight on the space shuttle. And a brand new, spanking new astronaut, 1998, driving down the road. And these two little black boys are standing with their father in their orange spacesuits. And their father points up to the fire truck and is basically saying, look at that guy. And when we make eye contact, it was almost how as though these kids had this rocket fuel going through their veins and they were about to launch off of that street because they saw me and they saw the possibilities of them doing what they wanted to do as being astronauts. So that was my first eye-opening moment that said, okay, this does matter, and that what you're doing, people are watching.
That story came from reporter Tal Pinchevsky. Leland Melvin has written a book. It's called Chasing Space, an astronaut's story of grit, grace, and second chances. We'll have a link to it and to Leland's personal website at onlyagame.org. More than three decades ago, writer Allison McGee joined the YWCA in Minneapolis. It was the first and only gym she ever joined.
In the back of a kitchen drawer, all my outdated Uptown YWCA membership cards are rubber banded together. The oldest shows a woman with long dark hair barely out of college. Hello, girl I used to be.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef, providing exceptional dry-aged beef via the most transparent and direct supply chain possible. They're family ranchers who believe in their customers' right to know where their food comes from. Come for their family's six-generation story and stay for the quality of their beef. Try their single-animal, dry-aged ground beef or their 20-ounce dry-aged ribeyes shipped right to your door. They'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
Welcome to the 21st century.
Do you see Jesus in the burnt toast?
Do you realize that literally there is a bucket of condoms by the exit?
Why is this happening? Why is this happening to me?
We cannot just say stop, I want to get off.
Invisibilia, season 5.
No easy answers, just the right questions.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for 3 stories you should know. That sound of Colts fans booing Andrew Luck last Saturday after news broke that the 29-year-old quarterback is retiring from the NFL. And that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by The Washington Post's Jerry Brewer and by the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Karen.
All right, Jerry, get us started.
Karen, Nora, the story that might define the NFL season has already happened. Andrew Luck at 29 years old has left the game because of a rash of injuries over the past 4 years. He says it's just robbed him of his passion for the game. It is one of the most modern stories because the news broke on Twitter and it was delivered to Colts fans in the middle of a preseason game, which is why they booed. But the greater question now becomes, without one of the best players in the NFL, what is going to be the lasting impact?
The thing that stands out most to me is that okay, so Luck was drafted in 2012, and he's part of this 2012 quarterback class that's always been really fascinating to me. Luck was in an offense that, once it had him, kind of looked at him as the savior to all their problems, and they felt like they didn't need to invest in offensive linemen. And as a result of that, plus, you know, to a degree, his own playing style, he was hit more than really any quarterback in football, and it was a major factor in him getting hurt so much. And it led to this tragedy for the sport because this is one of the most exciting players that we've had.
Colts fans are upset, right? They booed. They're claiming that they're going to give up their season tickets, but then they're not giving up their season
tickets.
They will not. That's not really happening.
Of course not.
As you point out, they're really upset at the wrong person. And I am not one of those people who wants to see all the football players walk away from the game so that the game dies. Like, I really love football. I want it to continue. But I would like to see enough players walk away from the game for teams and owners and coaches and all of these people to realize that if you don't do more to protect the bodies and the minds of these men, your product will suffer. How many more does the game have to lose for that to happen, Jerry?
Karen, I think we would need 6 to 8, maybe even a dozen. You saw San Francisco linebacker Patrick Willis, one of the best linebackers in the league, was on a Hall of Fame track. He quit a couple of years ago. Rob Gronkowski, mm-hmm. He seemed like he played for 50 years, but he was only 29 years old
right.
When he retired. So if you had another rash in which players decided, look, hey, I've made a lot of money and it's my time, I think that would force the NFL to consider things. But we're still talking about inching in that direction instead of really marching in the direction.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to talk about something that is somewhat related. Since last Saturday, retired NFL fullback LaRon McClain has been tweeting about his struggles getting help under the billion-dollar NFL concussion settlement. And most of what he says I can't actually say on the radio, but here are a few cleaned-up phrases. Help me, please. Please pray for me. Scared for my life. I mean, these are the kinds of things he's talking about. So I think it's a good time to talk about what's been going on with the NFL's concussion settlement. So the NFL has paid out on many of the largest, most serious claims. And at last count, $660 million in awards had been approved. But we all know CTE can't be diagnosed until after death. So more than 60% of the players filing under the settlement are filing under early or moderate dementia. And of the 1,800 of those claims filed, only 312 have been paid. And what players like McLean and their families are saying is that they need help, and instead they're getting buried under a never-ending stream of paperwork and appeals and audits. Nora, what do you make of all this?
Well, first and foremost, it's just really sad.
Yeah.
Because when you read those tweets, I'm not a doctor, of course, yeah. But they don't read as though they're coming from someone who's in a clear frame of mind. It just makes you feel sort of helpless and just sort of disgusted that an organization as powerful as the NFL is letting that happen. You know that it's within their power to do a lot. And yeah. So when you see an example like that, you just feel like, why? Like, why is this guy getting buried in paperwork? That's been the main challenge for guys, is just all of the paperwork. How do you get approved? When do you get approved? And does it happen in time? Because, of course, mm-hmm. they're sort of fighting a clock here. If they feel like they have an ailment that mostly falls into the category of something degenerative.
Karen and Nora, the NFL has to ask itself a question. Are we a tough sport that is going to take care of its players during their careers and after? Or are we a barbaric sport? The more stories that we hear about players contemplating or following through on suicide because something is wrong with their head. I think of a running back, Larry Johnson, who played for the Kansas City Chiefs. There was a Washington Post story by Kent Babb written about how he's worried that he's losing it. The league, right now, they're just trying to protect the money that they have. They need to worry about protecting the reputation of the sport down the road. And so in that sense, compassion is also good strategy. And yeah. The NFL needs to start thinking more strategically about this issue.
Yeah, it's true. It's a really weird comparison that keeps popping into my mind. So my husband and I right now are fighting with a extended warranty company about our dishwasher, which isn't working properly. And it is so annoying because they just keep wanting more things. Like, I want a photo. No, I want 5 photos. And the NFL is using these tactics on its players who the very nature of their disease makes it difficult to jump through all these hoops. Call me crazy, but the NFL should be better than an extended warranty company. All right, Nora, you do you.
Wow. Okay, so we have kind of an all football.
We do.
Three
it's
things.
Happening.
This is my jam. but with a little bit of soccer thrown in, because I am here to talk about soccer god Carly Lloyd, who on August 20th nailed a 55-yard field goal. Ooh-hoo. She did have a running start at a Ravens-Eagles joint practice. Now, this happened and it set the world ablaze because there was some talk in the aftermath about could she kick in an NFL game? And then there was a reaction to that, which was really fascinating to me because you had a lot of people who I swear to you have never considered the tackling skills of a kicker in their entire lives. All of a sudden, really concerned.
Really worried.
She might not be able to do it and she might get taken out. And people just tell on themselves so easily. It's wonderful. So I don't really care if Carly Lloyd is like an amazing NFL kicker. Like, she's an amazing soccer player. That's the point. My thing is, I think the reaction to this is crazy because we shift so quickly into she needs to prove herself worthy when it's like, okay, regular season, it would still be really cool. But also, people were talking about this relative to her kicking in an NFL preseason game.
Uh-huh.
As someone who watched a more than 3.5-hour preseason game on Thursday night, do you know what a blessing Carly Lloyd would have been? We need Carly Lloyd. Carly Lloyd does not need us.
Nora, Sebastian Janikowski, 260-pound kicker, played in the NFL for 19 seasons. He had 19 career tackles. Kickers avoid contact. Like you said, that is a fake concern. For people who wonder if it's just going to be this giant PR stunt, when has an NFL team ever liked distraction? I would like to see her try it just because I'm curious. But I don't think about it necessarily from a gender standpoint. I think about it from the standpoint of, here's one of the greatest athletes of all time in one sport testing herself in another. And I think you learn a lot about greatness through some of these things.
You don't see this as a gender thing, but for me, Carly Lloyd's gender is really important. And this is where I'm coming from. So I'm all about the silly stories today. So I have this friend, and she is the biggest NFL fan I know, male or female. But the last time she and I went to a game together, we're standing in the security line and we get the no chicks chant.
Wait.
Right. Yeah. Patriots game. Craziness. And then we get to our seats and she's telling me all about, she's a tiny little thing. She's telling me all about how she can't find a shirt in her size that isn't pink, sparkly, or like overtly sexy. And she loves this game more than anyone I know. And yet it just keeps like telling her that she doesn't belong. And I know that if she saw Carly Lloyd on the field, she would know that she belongs. And maybe this is me being way overly optimistic, but maybe the next time someone starts the no chick chants in the security line, someone will tell them to shut up.
Okay, wait, hold on. If any woman is at a Patriots game and has people yelling no chicks at them, like, my DMs are open for you. That's unbelievable. Yeah. God, I'm mad. I think I come at it a little bit more from Jerry's perspective where it's just, I just want to see someone try something. And then all of a sudden, instead of that being the central focus, it's,
well, what if she has to make a tackle?
And that's the gendered part of it, which I find very frustrating because it is getting in the way of watching someone test themselves as an athlete. So I think that's why I find it so frustrating.
All right. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Washington Post's Jerry Brewer and the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. I'm going to go like yell now.
For some, a gym is just a place to go and work out. But for Allison McGee, a writer living in Minneapolis, it's something more.
In the back of a kitchen drawer, all my outdated Uptown YWCA membership cards are rubber banded together. The oldest shows a woman with long dark hair, barely out of college. Hello, girl I used to be. The most recent shows a middle-aged woman with a messy blonde bob. The day the Uptown Y opened, decades ago now, was the day I became a member. It was the first and only gym I've ever joined. The Y holds the invisible ghosts of my past selves. There's the locker I stood before after showering when I was 9 months pregnant and turned to see a gaggle of high school girls staring at me, some unable to stop laughing at the sheer size of my belly, a kind of fascinated horror in their eyes. There's the Fit Kids gym, which I privately nicknamed the Sick Kids gym, where I used to leave my three little kids so I could work out. There's the huge pool we used to haul them to on steamy Minneapolis summer days. There's the desk behind which a male staffer said when he overheard me, the focused and quiet Y member who goes there solo and only to work out, laugh unexpectedly, "Whoa, you really should smile more. It totally changes your look." To which I, long schooled in womanhood, internally responded, "Has anyone in your life ever told you to smile more?" But outwardly just smiled a weary, polite smile. There's the track around which, when it's too hot or cold or icy outside, I have run, jogged, walked, lunged, and intervaled approximately 3,000 times. There's the drinking fountain where I've patiently waited behind others and where others have patiently waited behind me. There's the weight room where, over 3 years, I once observed in wonder a young, round, soft woman gradually transform herself into one of the most muscular people I have ever seen. She still goes to the Y, and so do I. And there's the hallway where, after an absence of months, I once saw a beautiful woman I'd worked out next to for years walking unsteadily between her two sons. The unrecognition on her face, the protectiveness of her sons, hushed me. Early onset dementia. I watched her walk around the track, each son holding an arm. Her body remembered its routines, the comfort and calm of ritualized movement. I can relate to that. Though I've moved many times, from various apartments to various houses, the Uptown Y, despite remodeling, policy changes, additions and subtractions of machines and classes, aerobics to Zumba to spin to body flow to vinyasa, has remained a constant in my life. When I joined the Y, I was childless and driven and getting up at 4:30 in the morning to write and write in hopes that someday, somehow, I would write the beautiful book I dreamed of writing. Now, at midlife, children grown, I'm still driven. That beautiful book I dream of writing still hovers before me, invisible in the invisible air. Once, a few years ago when I was leaving the track for the weight room, a man came up to me. "Are you Allison, the writer?" he said. "My wife and I love your novels." I looked at him in surprise, this man I didn't recognize, and thanked him. Has he too been coming to the Y for all these years? Over a lifetime, we returned to certain places again and again and again. Physical manifestations of how and where we have chosen to spend our lives. Sometimes I stop and close my eyes and breathe and thank my muscles and bones and blood and brain and heart for all the work they do on my behalf, day in and day out, year in and year out, to keep me alive. How they will keep doing so until the moment I die. How magical our bodies are and the memories they hold. In those moments, the Uptown Y, mundane cinder block building that it is, feels sacred to me, a temple of time and work and love and memory.
Allison McGee is a New York Times bestselling writer. Her most recent novels are Never Coming Back and What I Leave Behind. We first aired her essay last August. Clemson fan Dean Cox threw about $200 worth of $2 bills in the air at the 2014 Citrus Bowl. He says it was well worth it.
"Hey, I've got friends in Oklahoma that had I not have did that, we would have never met."
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Take a deeper dive into the art, lives, and legacies of Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, and the women who played a vital role in inventing American popular music.
Be seeing you.
Watch videos, read essays, and hear the full Turning the Tables playlist at npr.org/turningthetables.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the small island of Pompeii had never before won an international soccer match until they got a coach who'd never before coached a team. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
All previous reports to the contrary, there is now a resolution to Antonio Brown's helmet drama, and it comes with a paycheck, right?
And it's great. It turns out that now, having gone through this whole thing, including going to arbitrators and losing, by the way, Antonio Brown is not only going to have a designer helmet made for him, he's going to get paid for it. And according to his agent, he has, quote unquote, multiple offers from various companies to custom make a helmet for him and pay him for using it. If this was just a ploy to get more money, this is a masterpiece.
Just to catch people up who might be confused, the helmet Brown had used his entire career was discontinued, and he had a lot of trouble finding a new one. Do you really think this is over this time? I mean, the new helmet hasn't actually been made, let alone approved. There's still time for a third grievance over this thing.
Oh, I'm sure, but he's going to get his check whether the thing is approved or not. So, I mean, it's not his fault if it doesn't get approved. They're going to pay him to put his name on it, and you know, I think this, you know, this will also speed his recovery from the burns on his feet he got in Paris for cryotherapy.
We shouldn't laugh. I'm sure it was very painful.
They were very painful, but they are unique in the annals of NFL injuries.
That's true. Charlie, when Ice Cube launched the Big Three Basketball League in 2017, it was billed as a way for former NBA players to keep playing. But now it seems like it might be a way for former NBA players to make it back to the NBA, right?
Yeah, it looks like Joe Johnson may get a, he's going to work out for a bunch of teams. I did not realize Joe Johnson was 38 years old, but it does seem like he was drafted by the Boston Celtics shortly after Bob Cousy. He was the Big Three League MVP, and now he's going to work out for the Clippers and the Bucks and the 76ers. If he can be the new Vince Carter, that's fine with me. I don't care.
Absolutely. All right, quiz time, Charlie. Michael Jordan retired from the NBA more than 15 years ago. So how much do you think he made on his endorsement deal with Nike last year?
$145 million? By any chance?
I think it's 130.
So, yeah, I mean, the guy can make money that he doesn't even know he's making, I think. You know, I think he gets surprised every couple of months with another, like, statement from somewhere. Oh, look, I made $14 million
on this. Oh, look at that.
Look at that, yeah.
My favorite part
of I owned Guam. When did that happen?
My favorite part of this is that Jordan earns more than the next six closest earners combined.
That's right.
That's LeBron James, Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, Kobe Bryant, James Harden, and Zion Williamson. I guess they should be like Mike, huh?
They should try to be like Mike. Good for Zion, by the way, to get in the, he hadn't even played a game in the NBA yet.
The equal pay fight has come to the UFC, Charlie. Paige VanZant has one more fight left on her contract, and then she says she wants a, quote, significant pay raise. And before we start receiving emails, yes, women headline UFC events, and yes, people pay to watch them, right?
Certainly. This is a woman who has broken the same arm twice. She's only 25. I mean, she's obviously got a career ahead of her on this, and she makes more money on Instagram than she does fighting. You know, there's a life to be had outside of the octagon, and she's cashing in on it. The problem is she's got to stay in the octagon, and while she does that, she should get paid more.
Carolina Panthers running back Christian McCaffrey has taken issue with his Madden 20 avatar. What, did they get his ratings wrong?
Actually, no, Karen. They depicted him wearing a hand warmer on his belt, which he never does. No, actually, well, that's true, by
that
the way.
Is
and
true. That, yeah,
and
yeah.
That's what he complained about, because Christian McCaffrey is a cool guy. But actually, the Christian McCaffrey in the Madden game is a black player, and Christian McCaffrey is definitely not.
My favorite response is from Christian McCaffrey's mom.
That's right.
Who says, well, maybe, oops.
Yeah, sorry you had to find out this way. At 87 Ed, who I presume is his father, may not be your real dad.
And finally, Charlie, Milwaukee Brewers star Christian Yelich posed nude for ESPN's Body Issue. And a Twitter user named Roxanne J was dismayed. She said, quote, "It's really sad to see how you didn't give a thought about all those young kids that idolize you before doing your naked photo shoot, straight face emoji, distasteful." How did Yelich respond?
Well, he changed his walk-up music to Roxanne. That was his second response to Roxanne J.
Yeah.
The first one was to tell her to relax, and he did not have the guts to use Relax by Frankie Goes to Hollywood as his walk-up music prior to that.
Charlie Pierce joins us each week at this time here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Next Saturday, Texas A&M will be in South Carolina to play the Clemson Tigers, college football's reigning national champion. Last year's game between these two powerhouses took place in College Station, the home of the Texas A&M Aggies. Clemson fans made a big impression there, as they always do, with the help of a very unusual currency. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
Adam Drake is an easygoing guy. In fact, you can call him almost anything you like.
Adam, Drake, the Drake, I mean, you know, whatever. As long as it's not late for the chicken.
The Chicken is the Dixie Chicken restaurant, a hotspot before and after Texas A&M home games.
And I will say that Aggie fans are the nicest, best fan base in the entire world.
Drake works for Dixie Chicken, so you'd expect him to say that. But lots of rival fan groups also visit the restaurant when their teams are in town.
I've been there for games with the University of Texas. The Baylor Bears have come in. Tennessee and Alabama and Auburn, all these great SEC schools. But honestly, the best that has been there, it has been Clemson.
What sets fans of the Clemson Tigers apart? It all began with a man named George Bennett.
We've just had a lot of fun with it down through the years.
Bennett, Clemson class of 1955, returned to his alma mater in 1967 to work in fundraising and development. At that time, Clemson's biggest annual game was against Georgia Tech, which had been played in Atlanta almost every year since 1903.
And that was kind of what we called our big money game, so to speak. We were getting a pretty hefty paycheck.
Clemson is a national power now, but back in the 70s, the Tigers were a team top programs like Georgia Tech would pay to come to town and usually lose. But Clemson rooters loved the Georgia Tech game. Bennett estimates that each year, 15,000 to 17,000 Clemson fans would make the 100-mile trip to Atlanta. They'd spend lots of money in the city's restaurants, hotels, and stores. But in early 1977, Georgia Tech contacted Clemson to say,
"We're going to cancel our contract and we're going to replace you with William and Mary."
Bennett was angry that Clemson was being snubbed in favor of a mediocre football program from a non-major conference. As for the Atlanta business community,
"As the manager of the Hyatt Hotel said, well, I really hope that William will bring Mary because that'll be the biggest crowd they bring down here."
But before the contract expired, Clemson and Georgia Tech were scheduled to play one more game on September 24, 1977. George Bennett started thinking about a way to make Clemson's traditional rival regret its decision.
So that's when I came up with the idea, let's everybody take $2 bills down to Atlanta.
Bennett wanted people to realize the economic impact the Clemson community made when it traveled.
Nobody was using a $2 bill at all. That was the whole deal, was to do something that was unusual. 10 twos would make a bigger impact than a $20 bill would.
So Bennett rallied Tigers fans. On September 24th, they arrived by the thousands in Atlanta for the big Georgia Tech game. In Bennett's words, they covered the city in $2 bills.
Cab drivers, the hotel clerks, the bellhops, waitresses and waiters in restaurants. We would tell people, you know, this is a Clemson $2 bill. We had such a big time with it. The Atlanta Constitution Journal wrote a big story about it, and so that was the start of it.
It was too late to put Georgia Tech games back on the schedule, but Bennett thought it would be a good idea to keep bringing $2 bills to away games. And then
we decided to mark the $2 bills with tiger paws on it.
Bennett bought an ink pad, Clemson orange, of course, and a custom logo stamp. Clemson's logo was based on an actual paw print of a Bengal tiger, and he got to work stamping bills. He encouraged others to do the same.
And tonight from Jacksonville, Florida, on a cool December evening, the 33rd Gator Bowl game.
On December 30th, 1977, Bennett and his fellow Clemsonians distributed the $2 bills at the Gator Bowl as Clemson played Pittsburgh. Bennett says bowl committee members began asking for them. It became a college football sensation.
"Anything Clemson, I'm there."
That's Dean Cox. His friends, and he has a lot of them all around the country, call him the Hat.
"I'm dressed in orange and purple, and that big orange cowboy hat is always there. When I've got on that orange blazer, my pocket where a handkerchief usually goes is $2 bills. Now, a lot of people says, man, you better take those out. You're going to get mugged. But I hadn't been mugged yet.
The Hat stamps his own $2 bills. He's been developing his technique for 4 decades.
"The tiger paw has got to be stamped perfect. It's got to be stamped, turned to 1 o'clock. I'll do one on the left bottom corner, I'll do one. And then the right top corner, I'll do one. Well, then it looks like a tiger stepping."
For the last 10 years under head coach Dabo Sweeney, the Tigers have been a powerhouse. And with the team in bigger bowl games, there have been more opportunities for Clemson fans to distribute their orange and green cabbage. the hat's correctly stamped $2 bills were out in full force at the 2014 Citrus Bowl, where Clemson took on Oklahoma.
And we were on the first row of the upper deck. I told the Oklahoma people, I said, every time we score, I'm going to throw $2 bills overboard to the people in the lower deck.
Early on, the game was a blowout.
And the Oklahoma people wanted to throw $2 bills, so they came over. They said, wait, y'all are fixing the score. Can I have a couple to throw? And finally, my wife, she gave me that look, and she said, you do realize $2 bills are real money.
Hey, man, that gets expensive. How much do you think you spent that day?
I would say I probably threw $200 worth of $2 bills that day.
But the hat says it was worth it.
Hey, I've got friends in Oklahoma that had I not have did that, we would have never met.
Once in Columbia, South Carolina, the hat tried to buy something at the home stadium of the arch-rival University of South Carolina Gamecocks.
It was just like, nope, we're not taking that.
So what was your response?
We gave him a 20.
But almost everywhere else, the Clemson $2 bill is coveted. George Bennett saw that firsthand before the Orange Bowl a few years ago when he and his wife checked into a Miami hotel.
And all of a sudden, this guy comes walking up, and he's speaking a foreign language that I didn't know. I asked the clerks behind the desk, said, what does he want? They said, he wants one of your $2 bills. So I gave him a $2 bill. Well, he turned around and gave me €100.
Bennett says his wife later exchanged that 100 euro note for $129.
And all the Clemson people were saying, where is that guy? Where is that guy? I've got plenty of $2 bills. I'd be glad to give him, you know.
I'm Bill Harley. I'm senior vice president here with First Citizens Bank, Clemson, South Carolina.
Harley's bank provides orange ink pads and tiger paw stamps right alongside the withdrawal and deposit slips so customers can stamp their $2 bills right on the premises. But the demand for the bank's crisp $2 bills often exceeds the supply. That led to a problem right before the 2017 college football national title game between Clemson and Alabama.
These people got really upset at us that we'd only give them $50 worth of $2 bills, so they stole our stamps.
No one at the bank really seemed to mind. Clemson beat Alabama 35-31 for the 2017 national title. 2 years later, Clemson again played for the national title. The hat was there with his wife. He brought 400 $2 bills.
The Tigers reclaim their crown by crushing Alabama.
The hat received congratulatory messages from friends he had met in rival college towns across the country, including from Adam Drake at the Dixie Chicken. Georgia Tech played just one game against William & Mary. That was in 1979. The Clemson-Georgia Tech rivalry resumed in 1983, but that probably had more to do with the fact that Georgia Tech had joined the ACC, the conference Clemson was in. So George Bennett's idea for the Clemson $2 bill may not have saved the Georgia Tech game, but it did establish a tradition.
I had no earthly idea that this would be going on as long as it is. The younger generation, they're really carrying it now. And as we always say, go Tigers.
That story came from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Kyrie Thompson. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. Special thanks this week to Arlo Moore-Bloom, whose internship has ended. But don't worry, we'll be hearing from Arlo again soon. We just approved his first story pitch. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.